Do you remember when Marsha Brady broke her nose and John Travolta was stuck in that plastic bubble? Then you should check out the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the big wheel generation who had no limits on their screen time and learned about making love from AM radio.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
We have almost 200 episodes preserving the cultural nuggets of our Gen X childhoods, from the Bee Gees and Barry Manilow to the Brady Bunch and Battle of the Network Stars. Every episode is packed with the shows you watched, the songs you listened to, the books you read, and even the posters on your wall. Remember this guy?
Hi, this is Sean Cassidy, and you are listening to the Pop Culture Preservation Society.
Were you Team Sean or Team Leif? It doesn't matter, because all Gen X childhoods are welcome here. And that's exactly what you'll find when you listen to the Pop Culture Preservation Society on your favorite podcasting app.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your Pop Culture Preservationists.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age, with a special emphasis on their lives behind the scenes. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Before I begin, I would like to give a very special shout out to a few new Patreon members. Thank you so much to Anna K, Matt C, and Joy B. I had the pleasure of chatting a bit with Anna, Matt, and Joy, and let me tell you, this show has the best listeners. It has been such an honor to get to know so many of you a little bit and to hear your stories. It's awesome to hear how each of you, all of you I've connected with, have been impacted by classic films and the lives we talk about here, and how they fit into your life. Keep them coming. Thanks, Anna, Matt, and Joy, and thank you to all of you who have been supporting the show on Patreon. Anyone else interested in what's going on over there, listen at the end of the show and I will tell you more. February is Black History Month. So, this month I will be sharing some amazing stories with you about individuals who have overcome extreme inequality as they follow their dreams and change the course of history while doing so. Behind all the glitz and glamour that enchants us about Hollywood's golden age, old Hollywood history is full of stories of injustice, unfairness, downright cruelty, and unimaginable strength and endurance, just to get to the same place as a white counterpart. I have covered the lives of Hattie McDaniel, Paul Robeson, Lena Horne, Billie Holiday, Bessie Smith, and Louise Beavers on this show. Each and every one of those individuals went through extreme hardships. They were denied opportunities, and they were treated cruelly. It was hard, really hard. Yet they all plowed their ways through and showed Hollywood that they could do it. And they did it pretty great. Each of these individuals made history, and they made it possible for those who came after them. They helped to make it a little easier for those who came next. This month, I will tell you about a few more trailblazers in the entertainment industry. I'll tell you about Sidney Poitier, I'll tell you about Butterfly McQueen, and today I will tell you about Dorothy Dandridge. The great biographer Donald Bogle helped me along with Dorothy's story, so a huge thank you to him. Thank you. Dorothy Dandridge was born on November 9, 1922, to parents Cyril and Ruby in Cleveland, Ohio. Both Cyril and Ruby were mixed race. Cyril was half black and half white, while Ruby was graced with a mix of Jamaican, Hispanic, white, and Native American. Dorothy joined older sister Vivian, who was born just a year and a half before Dorothy. Unfortunately, Cyril and Ruby's relationship was not a healthy one. They were complete opposites and had completely different visions for their lives. Cyril wanted calm and stability. Ruby wanted excitement and adventure. It finally came to the point where she couldn't bear living such a fixed life. So she took Vivian, who was still a baby, and she left her husband. She was pregnant at the time. Ruby named her second daughter Dorothy because she thought it would look beautiful on a movie theater marquee someday. Ruby herself had dreams of life in the performing arts. She wasn't sure that would happen for her, so she just redirected her dreams to her daughters. They could grow up to be stars. Cyril pleaded with Ruby to reconcile their marriage, but she was not interested. She created a pretty ugly case in the courts as they navigated through the divorce, alleging some horrible things against Cyril. He wanted to be a father to his daughters very badly, but Ruby did everything she could to prevent that. She moved frequently with the girls so Cyril couldn't find them. Once the long divorce battle concluded, she cut all ties with Cyril and refused to allow a relationship to exist between him and his daughters. She first told the girls that their father had no interest in them, that he didn't love them or care to see them. And then she eventually told them that he was dead. She gladly accepted the court-ordered child support payment from him, though. She received $10 per month, which would adjust to about $184 per month today. That wasn't going to cut it. Ruby would have to work in order to support herself and her daughters, so she took on jobs as a maid. As time allowed, she indulged in her love of performing by singing, dancing, and reading poetry at church events. From the time she was a toddler, little Dorothy loved watching her mother's passion and drive as she performed. When she was 4 years old, Dorothy filled in for her mother one evening when she was too exhausted to perform after a long day of work. And Dorothy proved to have the spark and vibrancy that could captivate an audience. Everyone loved Dorothy. She was such an adorable little girl. Ruby put together acts for her two daughters to perform as a duo. They did a variety of performances, comedic skits, dancing, singing, poetry. Vivian played the piano and Dorothy danced. "I wanted to dance and cavort and act all over the stage," she said. Around this same time, when Dorothy was 4 years old, her mother welcomed a new romantic partner into their lives and into their home. It was a woman named Geneva Williams, or Neva, who had just left her minister husband. From the moment Neva moved in, she became the dominant force in the family. She took over care of the girls and became their teacher, both academic and in dancing and singing. Dorothy and Vivian did not attend traditional school. Neva was very strict and often used physical discipline against the girls. Her temper was unpredictable. Their childhood became a permanent existence of walking on eggshells, every single day, never knowing when something they did would upset Neva. And when Neva was upset, she was cruel and abusive. Dorothy later recalled, "I had a crying childhood." The family eventually moved to Nashville, where Neva was from. Ruby and Neva saw dollar signs in their adorable, talented little girls. So they worked them hard on their training and routines and arranged for them to perform in small local venues. They were well received everywhere they performed and were soon being called the Wonder Children. Before long, they were performing in bigger venues and being booked throughout the South and making pretty good money for each performance. Enough that the girls were the primary supporters of the family of four. Things were going great, and then the Great Depression hit, And with it, their successful act came to a screeching halt. Dorothy was 8 years old and had already been working for half her life. Looking for new opportunities, Ruby, Neva, and the girls headed to Chicago. Life was really difficult during this time. Ruby had a lot of drive and determination, though, and she knew that the four of them held great talent, especially the girls, and that they could make something of that great talent, Great Depression or not. Ruby's mind became set on Hollywood, so she worked hard and saved every cent she could so they could afford the journey from Chicago to Los Angeles. And they did it. She was determined to get her daughters in the movies. But it wasn't going to be easy. The white Hollywood studios wanted dark-skinned black actors for their films, which they were casting almost exclusively in degrading servant roles. Dorothy and Vivian were mixed race with pretty light-colored skin, so they were instantly met with rejection from the studios. They weren't dark enough for the white Hollywood studios. It was in Los Angeles where Dorothy and Vivian attended school for the very first time in their lives, and they were finally able to make and keep friends. One of these friends also took voice lessons from Neva, and the girls became good friends with her. Her name was Etta Jones. The three of them sounded beautiful together, so Ruby and Neva organized a new group called the Dandridge Sisters, which Dorothy resented since Etta was not their sister. But they did as they were told. In 1934, when Dorothy was 11 years old, the Dandridge Sisters won a talent contest on a local Los Angeles radio station. The following year, Ruby signed them up to spend the Christmas season in Hawaii performing in a circus sideshow. The girls did attend some school while in Hawaii, but when their regular school in Los Angeles wouldn't accept that work towards their coursework, Ruby decided they would just drop out of school. There was no time for it when she had them so busy performing all the time. So when Dorothy Dandridge was 13 years old, she was officially done with her formal education. The Dandridge Sisters also performed as a quintet with two brothers, becoming the Five Rhythmatics. They sang beautifully together, they danced, and they performed skits. The Five Rhythmatics performed together most weekends for 5 years. As Dorothy and Vivian grew from little girls to teenagers, the abuse became more consistent and more severe at the hands of Neva. As their bodies changed and developed, Neva kept their developing breasts bound tightly, every single day. Her intentions were to hide or minimize growth so grown men would not stare at them or assault them. She was a harsh and controlling presence in their lives. Although Ruby was their mother, she had given almost complete parental control over to Neva the moment she entered their lives. Ruby was busy working, and when she wasn't working, she was out looking for opportunities in show business for her daughters, with her sights set on the movies. Ruby's dreams came true for the Dandridge Sisters when she landed them in a song and dance sequence in the big broadcast of 1936 at Paramount. The star-studded vaudeville and radio star Big Screen Musical Review showcased George Burns and Gracie Allen, Bing Crosby, Bill Bojangles Robinson, Ethel Merman, and the Nicholas Brothers. Dorothy was 14 years old when they appeared in the big broadcast of 1936, and she was so cute in her performance. From the big broadcast of 1936, the Dandridge Sisters secured more musical numbers in movies, appearing with some great stars of the day. One such star being Louis Armstrong, who helped the girls by introducing them to his manager, Joe Glazer. As their manager, Joe Glazer envisioned a different path for the talented and beautiful Dandridge Sisters. The place to be for black entertainers was the Cotton Club in New York. The Cotton Club was frequented by sophisticated upper-class white patrons and showcased primarily black talent. And Joe Glazer knew the Dandridge Sisters needed to perform on that stage. Other prominent black entertainers who performed at the Cotton Club were Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Lena Horne, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Cab Calloway. When Dorothy was 15 years old, she, Vivian, and Etta were accompanied by Neva and headed east for an engagement at the Cotton Club. It was the summer of 1938. The famous Nicholas Brothers dance duo, Fayard and Harold, were also regulars on the Cotton Club stage, and they were there during the Dandridge sisters' engagement. The younger of the two, Harold, was enchanted by the sweet and wholesome Dorothy Dandridge, and the two began seeing each other. Neva had put a lot of very negative ideas in Dorothy and Vivian's heads regarding men. Plus, she was also just a good, wholesome girl and wasn't interested in moving too fast with a man. She was just a teenage girl, after all. Dorothy and Harold spent little to no time alone. There was always someone accompanying them, usually Dorothy's sister and friends. And Neva was always hovering nearby. At one point, a friend of Dorothy's was claiming that Dorothy was pregnant, which wasn't true or at all possible. Neva flew into a rage and assaulted Dorothy in a vicious way. I'm not going to share the details, but basically, she sexually assaulted Dorothy by checking for herself if she was a virgin or not. This assault, on top of the years of physical and emotional abuse leading up to it, caused Dorothy to hit her breaking point. She fought back for the very first time, and she fought back hard. She recalled it like this, quote, "I had never struck her before, nor anyone, but it felt good. I walloped her hard. I clawed and scratched and punched. I had her against the wall and I pummeled, end quote. This was the last time Neva ever laid a hand on Dorothy. Her power had been taken away. Meanwhile, the Dandridge Sisters Act received glowing reviews, and syndicated critics' reviews appeared in newspapers across the U.S., including in Cleveland, Ohio, where Dorothy and Vivian's father came upon a review one day. He was shocked and overjoyed to read about his daughters that he'd wanted so desperately to know and love, and he was happy to finally know how to find them. He connected with them by telephone in New York, and once they approved of it, he was on a bus to see them. You can imagine how emotionally confusing this must have been for the girls. I think by this time, Ruby had confessed to them that their father wasn't actually dead, he just didn't want anything to do with them, which was a lie. So they had been told their entire lives that their dad was either dead or had abandoned them, and this idea became ingrained in their minds and emotions. When really, he tried very hard to remain in their lives and to be a present father. He had searched for them for years. Ruby had just always been one step ahead of him. So when Cyril traveled to New York to see his long-estranged daughters, it was a pretty delicate situation. And it didn't end with the outcome Cyril had hoped for. Too much damage had been done at the hands of the girl's mother, Ruby. Cyril Dandridge would never have a relationship with his daughters. In 1939, the Dandridge sisters took a little hiatus from the Cotton Club to go on a European tour, arranged by manager Joe Glazier. Unfortunately, the escalating war caused their tour to be cut short, but it was still a remarkable experience for them. The Cotton Club welcomed the trio back with open arms. They eventually landed back in Los Angeles, and the Nicholas brothers had the same fate as they were signed under contract with 20th Century Fox. Dorothy and Harold were able to continue their relationship, but their careers were always number one. Dorothy was kind and quiet, while Harold was described as energetic, optimistic, and self-indulgent. Traits that drew the reserved Dorothy in and were very exciting to be around. Unfortunately for Dorothy, those traits drew in many other women as well. Between the Nicholas brothers' engagements and the Dandridge sisters' engagements, it wasn't often Harold and Dorothy's schedules aligned for them to spend much quality time together. The Dandridge sisters' next venture was joining Jimmy Lunsford and his orchestra on a national tour. They toured for a year and a half and performed on four albums with the band. All of this before Dorothy Dandridge was even 18 years old. 18-year-old Dorothy Dandridge, hot off the tour, did a musical theater gig, did consistent nightclub acts, and did some work for a couple of black film production companies like Million Dollar Productions. Etta got married, which Dorothy and Vivian attributed to the downfall of the Dandridge sisters. But Etta claims it was Dorothy's solo aspirations. Whatever the reason, the Dandridge sisters' time was through. Dorothy's big Hollywood break came when her boyfriend, Harold Nicholas, persuaded Fox to include Dorothy in their upcoming movie, Sun Valley Serenade, in 1941, when she was 19 years old. She did the Chattanooga choo-choo with the Nicholas brothers. The chemistry and magic between the Nicholas brothers and Dorothy Dandridge was undeniable, and this film opened up great professional opportunities for her. Still, Dorothy Dandridge was black. And as accomplished as she was, that prevented her from catapulting to superstardom. Dorothy was considered too striking and beautiful to be cast in the stereotypical maid roles at the major studios, and her skin was a bit too dark to be even considered for a leading female role. Although there were limitations in her professional life, Dorothy's personal life was going well. 19-year-old Dorothy Dandridge and 21-year-old Harold Nicholas got married on September 6, 1942. They bought a small home near Harold's mother's house, and Dorothy had a wonderful time decorating and furnishing it. She'd lived a life on the road for most of her life, so she was ecstatic to have a home to make her own. A hopeful, safe place. She didn't feel completely safe within its walls, though. She had locked up her traumatic assault tightly, so she couldn't help but be very closed off with her new husband. Here is how she recalled their wedding night. Remember, she's only 19 years old. Quote, "I didn't know what to do. Harold had much experience with girls, so whatever he expected, he didn't get. I tried not to show it, but everything in my background contributed to making me feel that this normal event was a violation." End quote. Dorothy blamed herself, but she, of course, was not to blame. She was a victim of sexual abuse, and she was terrified. Within just days of their wedding, Dorothy suspected Harold was cheating on her with a chorus girl. As each passing day went by, Harold spent less and less time at home. The marriage was crumbling before it was even given a chance. The clearest sign of the situation came when Harold and Dorothy were in a car accident which resulted in a back injury for Dorothy. And Harold didn't visit her in the hospital once. The marriage may have ended at that point, except for the fact that Dorothy discovered she was pregnant. Dorothy Dandridge, bless her heart, had the same thought countless women throughout the history of time have thought. Maybe a baby will fix their marriage. She got her answer before the baby even entered the world. When she went into labor on September 1, 1943, Harold drove her to his brother and sister-in-law's house, Fayard and Jerry, where just Jerry was home because Fayard was serving in the military. And then Harold left with a friend to go golfing. He left their car for the women, but he did not leave the keys. Dorothy rode out the labor at Jerry's house for a long while, probably too long, but eventually a neighbor brought the women to the hospital, and Dorothy endured a very difficult labor before welcoming a baby girl at 3 a.m. The labor was intense, and forceps had been used to help the baby out. Very traumatic for both Dorothy and the baby. Harold showed up an hour later at 4 a.m. Little Harolyn Suzanne Nichols did bring a lot of love into the chilly home, during her infancy at least, and she certainly did not go without love herself. Ruby, Neva, and Harold's mother, who lived right next door, all doted on little Lynn. Once Fayard returned from his military duties, he and his wife Jerry welcomed a little boy, and the two families very closely raised their children together in those first months. Lynn was a little over a year older than Fayard and Jerry's little guy, Tony, and concerns began to arise when Tony started surpassing Lynn through important developmental milestones. Lynn was completely nonverbal and had a very difficult time regulating her emotions, temper tantrums as they were described. When it became apparent that Lynn didn't seem to recognize her family members, including Dorothy, her mother, Dorothy knew something was going on. Harold took the route of avoidance and denial, but Dorothy set off to discover what was causing these developmental delays and social-emotional difficulties, with her sister-in-law Jerry right by her side. They brought Lynn to pediatricians, psychoanalysts, and various specialists, determined to find a diagnosis so they could best treat and support the little girl. They were finally given the diagnosis they were looking for, but it was a difficult reality to accept, especially for the mid-1940s. Lynn was experiencing developmental delays because she had experienced a lack of oxygen to her brain during childbirth, and they were told she would never develop past a 6-year-old mental capacity. Dorothy blamed herself. One doctor told Dorothy, "The best thing for you to do is to get rid of her. Give her up and have another baby." Dorothy and Harold's unique situation, of course, did not help their marriage. Dorothy was living in a loveless marriage and was raising a child with special needs alongside a mostly absent father. And the bigger Lynn grew, the more difficult she was to manage and support. The positive side of their situation, however, was that they had the means to afford proper care, a nice home, and all of the things their little girl would need. It could have been so much worse. It was almost impossible for Dorothy to see the positive side, though. She began seeing a therapist herself as her mental health declined as she worked to accept her new reality and the seemingly end to her professional life. Dorothy later wrote, quote, "The only year or two of happiness in my life was in the time before I discovered how hopeless Lynn was," end quote. And considering what we know about the state of her marriage, it's sad to think that she considered that happiness. It finally came to the point where Dorothy couldn't emotionally handle the situation with her child anymore, and her therapist urged her to give Lynn over to someone else to raise. The only people that would take her, aside from an asylum, were the two unqualified women who raised Dorothy, Ruby and Neva. They weren't about to take care of Lynn for free, though. They only agreed to raise their granddaughter with special needs if Dorothy paid them $200 per month. And you know what these two women did? Lynn's own grandmother and step-grandmother? They turned around and paid another woman to take care of Lynn, paying her $50 per month. They took that extra $150 a month and tucked it right away into their own greedy pockets. Once Dorothy discovered this, she gave Lynn's care over to that other woman and the appropriate amount of money that went with it. Dorothy felt a weight off her shoulders once she was free of her daughter. The Nicholas brothers were royalty in Black Hollywood, and as such, they and their wives were part of the elite Black social circles. Once Lynn had been handed over, Dorothy and her sister-in-law Jerry hit the social scene. They wined and dined, but they also put their time to good use by helping organize fundraisers for political, social, and civil rights causes. Harold and Fayard spent most of their time on extensive European tours, and their wives were able to visit them on a few occasions. They really lived the lives of stars in most of the European countries that welcomed them in. They delighted in the freedom of segregation and racism in most of the places they were able to visit overseas. Dorothy also put focus back on her own career and joined the Actors Laboratory. She was one of their very first Black students, and Marilyn Monroe was one of her classmates. Eventually, Harold stopped sending money to Dorothy back home from Europe. Both he and Fayard were openly having multiple affairs, which of course was humiliating to their wives. But when the financial support stopped coming in, it was downright impossible to handle. Dorothy couldn't even pay the bills. She overdosed on sleeping pills on two separate occasions during this time, resulting in hospital stays after each incident. Dorothy Dandridge and Harold Nicholas separated in 1948 after 5 years of extremely unstable marriage. They officially divorced in 1951. After the ending of her marriage, Dorothy was all on her own for survival, so she devoted herself to rebuilding her career in entertainment. She hit the nightclub scene, and then she landed in one of the hippest nightclubs in LA, the Macambo. Desi Arnaz's singer in his band was sick, and Dorothy was brought in to fill her shoes. This exposure did great things for her, and she was soon securing bigger and better gigs than she had been before her debut at the Macambo, not only in Los Angeles, but in New York and Las Vegas. And then the Macambo invited her back to be a regular performer. By the fall of 1950, Dorothy had begun appearing in supporting roles in low-budget films, which soon garnered her the name Hollywood's New Glamour Queen. She was appearing in magazines, mostly Ebony, and was a guest on variety shows like The Ed Sullivan Show and The Steve Allen Show. She traveled all over the U.S. for singing engagements and, of course, was hit with constant reminders of the racism and bigotry that existed in many of the places she appeared. It was very common for her to not be permitted in any common areas of an establishment during her engagements, or sometimes not even be allowed to stay at that establishment at all. Just perform and leave, through the back entrance. Once banned from staying there, The Last Frontier in Vegas finally allowed her to stay there on one trip to perform, but she was forbidden from using the swimming pool. When Dorothy challenged this discrimination, they completely drained the swimming pool to prevent her from revolting and getting into the water. Dorothy's pianist, Nick Perito, was white, and he recalled what it was like for her to tour the United States. Quote, Dorothy was constantly reminded that she was different. She felt that she didn't belong anywhere. She was not really accepted by her own race because they felt her behavioral patterns were too white. And on the other hand, the whites regarded her as a Negro. Therefore, she was subject to all of the racial discrimination, except when she was performing on stage. This would cause her a lot of emotional stress, pain, and sorrow for years to come. End quote. During the early 1950s, still emotionally scarred from her difficult marriage, Dorothy dated several different men, but none of the relationships were very long-lived. I think she was just betrayed so many times by the people she loved and hoped would protect her that it was emotionally challenging for her to be in a healthy, trusting relationship. Not only that, but most of the men she dated were in it for the fun, but not the long-term commitment. A few of the men she had romantic relationships with were Harry Belafonte, Peter Lawford, and Otto Preminger. Director Otto Preminger was leading the charge in early 1954 on the all-black musical Carmen Jones for 20th Century Fox, and 31-year-old Dorothy Dandridge was very interested in securing the lead role of Carmen. When she showed up to meet Otto Preminger, he asked her what made her think she could pull off the role. Her reply, "Well, Mr. Preminger, what makes you think I can't?" So she went home and scrounged up a sexy slit skirt, an off-the-shoulder blouse, and a wild, tousled wig. She practiced moving as sexy and seductive as possible, and she went back to Otto Preminger the next day and put on her show for him. Dorothy was classy and elegant. She was often described as sultry and sexy in magazines like Ebony, but she didn't really like that. She was a class act, and that's how she wanted to be seen. So when Otto Preminger saw how she could add some sultry spice and flair to that class act, he knew he had found his Carmen. Before production on Carmen Jones even began, they were having an affair. 48-year-old Otto Preminger was married. Carmen Jones premiered on October 28, 1954, and just a few weeks earlier, Dorothy Dandridge had become the very first black woman to appear on the cover of Life magazine. Carmen Jones was a box office hit. It dazzled audiences, and Dorothy Dandridge was now considered one of the hottest actresses in Hollywood. And then came the Academy Award nominations on February 12, 1955. The nominees for Best Actress were Audrey Hepburn for Sabrina, Grace Kelly for The Country Girl, Jane Wyman for Magnificent Obsession, Judy Garland for A Star Is Born. That's amazing competition. But there was one more. Dorothy Dandridge for Carmen Jones. Dorothy Dandridge had become the first Black woman to ever be nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress. Only two other women had ever been nominated at all, both for Best Supporting Actress. Hattie McDaniel in 1940 for Gone with the Wind, which she of course made history by winning, and Ethel Waters in 1949 for Pinky. But as far as Best Actress, a Black woman had never been nominated. Not many Black actresses had been given the opportunity for lead roles to even have a chance. And there was Dorothy Dandridge, right up there with Judy Garland and Audrey Hepburn, taking another step forward for Black actors in Hollywood. Hollywood wasn't ready to take too big of a step, though. Grace Kelly took home the Oscar that year, and it wouldn't be until 2002, 47 years later, that a Black woman would win an Academy Award for Best Actress, Halle Berry for Monsters Ball. And guess how many there have been since then, which was, at the time of this recording, 24 years ago? Zero. Dorothy Dandridge knew why she didn't win the Academy Award. "If I were white, I could capture the world," she said. After the success of Carmen Jones and her highly praised Academy Award nomination, Dorothy Dandridge was offered a contract with 20th Century Fox. She was also offered a two-month booking in the Empire Room at the prestigious Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, making her the first Black performer to ever perform there. Dorothy Dandridge wasn't done making history. She did it again in 1958 with the first interracial kiss ever portrayed on screen in a Hollywood movie in The Decks Ran Red. Dorothy was always searching for something wholesome and real in her love life. She desperately wanted a life with Otto Preminger, but he wouldn't give himself fully to her. She was always just the hidden other woman to him. She met hotel manager of the Riviera in Las Vegas, Jack Dennison, shortly after that 1955 Academy Awards ceremony. A man that was described as a womanizer, sleazy, and a crafty manipulator. And as a crafty manipulator, he knew just what to do to lure Dorothy in. The two saw each other on and off, and by the time things with Otto Preminger had come to an end in 1958, Dorothy was seeing Jack exclusively. She recalled, quote, "I had someone. I needed someone so badly. Something in me cried out for a husband, for marriage, a home. I wanted to be in the backdrop of some man's life. I wanted a home life and not to have to bat around the country in hotels for the rest of my life." End quote. Sadly, these are exactly the sentiments a crafty manipulator loves to hear. And Jack Dennison had no problem taking advantage of Dorothy and her money. And then he convinced her to marry him. Dorothy Dandridge married Jack Dennison on June 23, 1959. She must have had a gut feeling about it because she allegedly took sedatives on their wedding day just to get through the day. By this time, she was heavily using a variety of uppers and downers and was completely relying on sleeping pills to sleep. Jack had promised Dorothy all of the things she had wanted. He promised that she could finally relax after working almost her entire life and she could just enjoy life. But then, reality slapped her hard in the face when Jack threatened to jump out of a window if she didn't perform at his new nightclub. She told him to jump. And then she performed in his dingy little nightclub. All of the promise of the life she wanted had completely vanished within weeks of getting married. And soon, Jack was emotionally and physically abusing her regularly. When she told him she wanted a divorce, he said he wouldn't allow it. Then he went on a rampage through their home, smashing all of her beloved crystal and china. Then took most of her jewelry and pawned it off. all while Dorothy had no choice but to continue working nightclub acts. Her brief placement at the top now greatly fallen, thanks mostly to the presence of Jack Dennison in her life. By the time she was able to secure a restraining order and divorce from Jack, her house had been foreclosed on, she owed a significant amount of back taxes to the IRS, and she had handed over an outrageous amount of money to what she learned was an oil investment scam. She was forced to file for bankruptcy in the spring of 1963, owing 77 creditors a total of $127,994.90. Today, that would be over $1.3 million. The very next day after her court hearing regarding her financial situation, the woman who had been raising Dorothy's daughter, Lynn, contacted Dorothy and told her she would no longer care for her because she hadn't been paid for the last 2 months. Lynn was 19 years old by this point, and she didn't know her mother at all. Dorothy couldn't or didn't want to even attempt to care for her, so she went to court and surrendered her parental rights. Lynn, who would need extensive support for the rest of her life, became a ward of the state and lived out the remainder of her life in a state mental hospital. From what I could find, Lynn died at the age of 60 in 2003. Dorothy Dandridge spiraled into the depths of depression after another traumatic marriage, her fall from fame, the loss of everything she had, and legally giving up her daughter to what was, for sure, a terrible life. Her pill use expanded and increased in frequency, and she was drinking a lot of alcohol. She was numbing the pain that she had felt for her whole existence. She briefly found love again with screenwriter and producer Abby Mann, but she didn't feel she deserved to be on his arm within the elite Hollywood social circles he was part of, so she allowed the relationship to end. That part of her life was over, she thought. She had lost all of her self-worth and felt as though she deserved the life that she had landed in. Dorothy had a few people on her side, and they helped to try to get her back on her feet. She had reconciled with former managers Earl Mills and Joe Glazier, and they worked to book singing and movie work for her. She did some nightclub appearances, and when interest rose from a Mexican film producer to have Dorothy do a couple of movies, she started the difficult process of transforming her health back to a good place. She cut way down on her drinking, started eating healthier, and began exercising. And then she broke her ankle at the gym, just when things were starting to look up for her. She was reportedly very worried about this injury and how it may ruin this promising opportunity to get back on track and reclaim her life. Dorothy had an appointment with her doctor to have her foot reset and be fitted with a cast on the morning of September 8, 1965. But early that morning, she asked manager Earl Mills to postpone the appointment. She needed more sleep. After several attempts later on in the day to get in contact with her, Mills went to Dorothy's apartment looking for her. He found her on the bathroom floor. She was gone. It was first reported that Dorothy died of a blood clot as a result of the break in her foot, but a toxicology report showed an overdose of an antidepressant. No one can really know if it was intentional or accidental. Either way, I hope she was able to find peace. Dorothy Dandridge died at just 42 years old. And now I would like to share some other interesting things about Dorothy Dandridge. Bullet point number one. I mentioned that Dorothy Dandridge was the first Black woman to be nominated for a Best Actress Academy Award. And Halle Berry was the first Black woman to win a Best Actress Academy Award 47 long years later. 3 years before her history-making win for Monsters Ball, Halle Berry played Dorothy Dandridge in the 1999 HBO film Introducing Dorothy Dandridge. Halle Berry said at the time, quote, "Many of her issues I have been dealing with in my own life. It fascinated me that somebody could have so much and yet never feel really happy. It became almost therapy as it made me realize that this cannot happen to me, that her story can never be my story. End quote. When Halle Berry's name was announced as the Best Actress winner in 2002, she was shocked. I remember watching it that night, and she looked like she was going to have a heart attack. She was absolutely shocked to hear her name. She sobbed for a long time, so hard she couldn't speak at the podium for a long time when she got up there. She just sobbed. When she could finally speak, she said, "This moment is so much bigger than me. This moment is for Dorothy Dandridge, Lena Horne, Diane Carroll. It's for the women that stand beside me, and it's for every nameless, faceless woman of color that now has a chance, because the door tonight has been opened." It's a really great Oscar moment. Go watch it and try not to cry, I dare you. Bullet point number two. Dorothy Dandridge was allegedly offered the role of Cleopatra, which, of course, Elizabeth Taylor snagged. Bullet point number three. Lena Horne referred to Dorothy Dandridge as our Marilyn Monroe. Bullet point number four. Dorothy had stage fright. She did not enjoy performing in nightclubs. It caused her a lot of anxiety, stemming back from being forced to perform as a small child. But her mother had pushed her into that life, and she was never able to find a way out. In conclusion, Dorothy Dandridge's name comes before many firsts in Black Hollywood history. First Black woman to appear on the cover of Life magazine. First Black entertainer to perform at the esteemed Waldorf Astoria in New York. First Black female presenter at the Academy Awards. First Black woman to be nominated for the Best Actress Academy Award. First Black person to share an interracial kiss in a Hollywood movie. Her name could have come before so many more firsts, but she was presented with enormous obstacles at every turn of life. And she was let down by almost everyone she tried to love, including her own mother. Dorothy Dandridge would have been a powerhouse star today. There would still be obstacles, but they would be so much easier to climb over. She would be loved and respected and applauded. When you see Halle Berry sobbing at the podium at the Academy Awards ceremony in 2002, you know she is feeling exactly this. She is feeling Dorothy Dandridge there on the stage with her, knowing that she deserved that honor. And what an honor it is to accept it for her and all the other remarkable Black actresses who slowly pushed open the doors, little by little, for her to finally be the one who could fit through and walk up onto that stage to be presented with that statuette. The Black women who were forced to use kitchen entrances at the luxury venues they were entertaining audiences at. The Black women who were not offered film roles because of the color of their skin. The Black women who endured things like hotel swimming pools being completely drained because of the fear they might dip their toe in the same water white people wanted to swim in. It really was a big deal when Halle Berry accepted that Oscar. And knowing stories like these, like Dorothy Dandridge's story, reminds us of exactly why it was a big deal. Dorothy Dandridge was right up there on that stage next to Halle Berry that night. Dorothy Dandridge was never given the choice to choose her own path in life. She was never allowed to find her own happiness, her own love, her own moments. I think, like so many of the other women we discuss, she just wanted love. Why is it that the easiest thing to give someone is the one thing that so many people are never given? Thank you, Dorothy Dandridge, for being the trailblazer you never knew you were. I hope you found your eternal peace and love. And thank you all for listening. Thank you again to Anna, Matt, and Joy for supporting the show over on Patreon. And guess what, guys? They now have access to some pretty sweet bonus content. I strive to never disappoint with the topics I choose over there. From fun vintage celebrity gossip to the history of cocktails that were slung every night at Ciro's, to fun facts about our favorite classic films, to interesting information about things like the Hays Code, old Hollywood hauntings, film set tragedies, the history of the Ziegfeld Follies or Academy Awards. There is a ton of stuff on Patreon that is guaranteed to make you smarter and fill your knowledge bank with all kinds of interesting tidbits that will impress your friends. Come check it out. Patreon.com/StarsOfTheGoldenAgePodcast. If you're not interested in that, that's okay. But please leave a positive rating and review where you listen to help others discover the show. Or better yet, share the show with your friends. Thanks, guys. Reach for the positive in every day, be kind to everyone you encounter, and have a great rest of your week. My primary source for this episode was the book Dorothy Dandridge, A Biography, by the great Donald Bogle. I also used the book Dorothy Dandridge, The Life and Legacy of One of Hollywood's First Successful Black Actresses, by Charles River Editors. The A&E biography documentary, Dorothy Dandridge, Little Lost Girl from 1998, and IMDb.